Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Reinhold. Philosophy was my first love. I was a philosophy major, and I always loved particularly hearing you explain really complicated ideas in a clear way, I will not say simple way, and often show how they're more complicated than maybe I thought before. But it really was a great way to start tonight off. And I'll reiterate that we have students in all different stages of life. I have students auditing. I have students coming for an MA, coming back after years. And it's one of the exciting things about teaching at Revel is that we have such a diverse, wonderful collection of people who come and bring their experience and their backgrounds to the material. So I can't stress enough what Dr. Reinhold was saying, and really welcome you tonight. We're going to start in medieval Sfarad and then go outwards to the diaspora, to the diaspora of the Sfaradim, and explore a particular stream within Jewish history, within the Sephardic experience, focusing particularly on the experience of the crypto Jews. And we'll talk about who those people are and who they aren't. And so to begin, let's go to the heartland. So this is medieval Iberia on the eve of 1492. 1492 is considered an anno mirabilis, a year of wonders, and in Spanish historiography, in other words, Spanish Catholic historiography, for whom 1492 starts a period, a true golden age, a siglo de oro of the Spanish Empire. And it starts on January 2nd, 1492, with the conquest of Granada, the last Muslim stronghold on the Iberian Peninsula down here. And with that conquest ends a several centuries, about 700-year struggle on the part of the Catholics to dislodge Islamic power from Spain. The Muslims arrive in Spain and take over the peninsula in 711 and transform the entire place and usher in a completely different sort of culture than the rest of Europe. This is a very good time for Jews. Jews come from all over the world to Spain, and Spain becomes, with it by the 9th century, really Spain becomes one of the great centers of Judaism in the world, producing, the highlights of poetry and philosophy and the engagement with science and revolutions in the way we read Tanakh and the way we read Gemara and Halakha, everything that you know, right? And that all happens in medieval Spain, in Sfarad. And 1492 is a closing of that, because with the conquest of Granada, with the dislodging of the last Muslim kingdom in Spain, what we have is a situation where the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, have some very big choices to make. And one of the choices that they make is to expel the Jews. And this was a difficult choice. This was a choice that was long in process, long in contention. And the whole reason for it, I mean, this is a whole semester at Revel to talk about the lead up to the expulsion and the cause of the expulsion and the aftermath of the expulsion. But one way to look at it is, starting in 1391, we have a wave of riots that run through all of Iberia. They go through, starting in Seville and running through the entire peninsula, with the exception of some pockets, which created these riots against Jews, created a mass of forced conversions. that left in its wake communities decimated, whole communities converted, or very large numbers of people murdered. And this created a very strange tension between the converted Jews and the rest of the Christians, which led to a lot of socio and economic problems, religious problems. This led to the rise of the Inquisition to try to investigate these converts. And ultimately, the decision was made that with the open Jews living in Spain, right, with Jews living their Jewish life, having open synagogues, and Batei Midrash, and kosher food, and all the things that make Jewish life, having that side by side, the converted Jews, meant that the converted Jews could never become good Christians. And so they made the fateful decision, elaborated in the Edict of Expulsion, which builds a very, very elaborate argument for why this was justified, for expelling the Jews. And the Jews were given a choice. You can convert and stay here and become a good Catholics, or you can leave. And we don't have hard numbers. About half stayed. The biggest portion went to Portugal. We're going to talk about Portugal in a little bit. And the rest left. And they left into the heart of the Mediterranean because, of course, France did not allow Jews. Germany had very few Jews and only in small pockets. London, England kicked out its Jews already 200 years before. So the places to go were North Africa, Italy, very important place to go, and the Ottoman Empire probably being the greatest, most important place, which allowed Jews to not only find stability, opportunity, religious freedom, but allowed them to be very, very close to Eretz Yisrael, in fact, resettle into Eretz Yisrael and create great communities in places like Tzfat and Tiberia and Hebron, Yerushalayim. So that's where they went. And where they went, they celebrated Pesach, of course. Here's a copy of a Haggadah from Venice with a Ladino translation. Ladino being Judeo-Spanish, Spanish written Hebrew characters. So here you have Tfardea Ranas, Las Ranas, okay? And so this is a great example of how they took their traditions that they developed over hundreds of years, took it with them into exile, into the lands of their new Jewish life, and recreated them in their own way. Of course, Italy was a major, major center of printing. So what we see here, the innovations with illustrations and with having multiple languages. There's another wonderful example of this where you have a Haggadah in Hebrew and Yiddish and Judeo-Italian and Judeo-Spanish. That's the sort of world that we have here. This is a beautiful example of a Haggadah from Amsterdam with the Perush of Yitzhak Abravanel. So the Jews who go into the Galut, they bring their holidays with them. They have open Judaism. They have open, robust communities throughout the Mediterranean, eventually into Holland as well, and into the satellites of the Western Sephardic community. And here's another example of that. This is a Sidur, really a Machzor. Segunda parte del Sidur contiene las Pascuas de Pesach, Shavuot y Sukkot. So here we have the holidays of Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, with the seal of the Amsterdam community. Take a look at that. What do you see? What animal? What mystic animal is that? That's the phoenix rising from the flames, because the Amsterdam community was born out of those Jews who stayed in Spain or who moved to Portugal thinking that they would have religious freedom in Portugal, who were forcibly converted in 1497, lived like Catholics for several generations, And eventually by the late 16th century, so about 100 years of living like Catholics and suffering auto de fés and Inquisition, this is the seal of the Inquisition, they found haven in Amsterdam, where they were able to return to Judaism and recreate a robust Jewish life. But those Jews who made it to Amsterdam were Jews who lived like conversos, who lived as Catholics for several generations. And during that time, they developed all sorts of ways of maintaining Judaism. Now, this was not the majority of those who converted. The majority of those who converted, it's pretty clear, over time, ha'olam k'minhago holech, they became Catholics. They became Christians. The most that we can say is that even those who became devout Catholics were marked by their converso past. They were marked by the fact that their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents converted from Judaism and that they belonged to a distinct group, almost a socio-ethnic community of the conversos that really fit into the niche of the merchant class in Iberia, specifically in Portugal. But they eventually, like I said, by the 1600s, they are in Amsterdam. Eventually they move to London and then to the American colonies of Holland and England that allowed religious freedom, places like Jamaica, places like Curaçao, places like New Amsterdam and Charleston and Newport, where we know, you know, the beginnings of American Judaism have their roots. But it's important to remember that that community that was able to rise again like the phoenix so powerfully, so robustly, has its origins in a community that lived underground, lived like Catholics for several generations. And those are the people we're going to look at. Who were the people who stayed behind, who converted, who did not leave? And how did they celebrate Pesach? And first we're going to look at a text from Luis de Carvajal. Luis de Carvajal is someone who I've spent about, I'd say, two decades with. He's someone who I've researched since my days in grad school, and I continue to do work on his family and his oeuvre of really fascinating religious texts that we keep on finding out more about. Luis de Carvajal comes from a large converso family from Spain that makes their way to New Spain, to Mexico, colonial Mexico. And he is brought before the Inquisition twice. On his first trial, he goes along with almost his entire family, including his uncle, who was the governor of a major province in northern New Spain, in the area around Monterrey, modern-day Mexico. And they're all brought before the Inquisition. And this is how Luis explains Passover for to the inquisitors. No, now, when we read this, I want you to pay close attention to how he explains it. What does it remind you of? What sources does it appear he's basing himself on? Remember, in the Catholic world at this time, even access to a Bible was difficult. Access to a Catholic Latin Bible was difficult to get your hands on. Certainly any vernacular Bibles were almost impossible. So let's take a look at what he says. So Passover was observed in that law of Moses in memory of when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and passed through the desert to the promised land, that the Passover lasted 7 days during which one had to eat unleavened bread. And also on that festival, you take a small white lamb, you cut its throat, and with the blood, you anoint the lintels of your doorways, because that is what God commanded the children of Israel to do when he took them out of Egypt. And when it was dead, it had to be roasted whole without breaking a single bone and eaten while standing as if you were ready to march. And you consume it entirely so that nothing is left over. and you should have your staves in your hands and your belts pulled tight, and you eat it so that nothing is left over. If perchance something's left over, you give it to a neighbor. And on the same festival, one was to eat the lamb and bitter lettuce and with unleavened bread. And the festival was called Fasse, which means Passover. And it lasted 7 days. The first and the last days were kept as a festival. And the lamb had to be killed and eaten on the evening before the first night at night. Now, this is oral testimony before the inquisitors. And notice the level of detail. And what does it seem like? What does it remind you of? Right? This is a deeply biblical understanding of Leil Pesach, Leil Shimurim. And it's very striking. And we know that Luis de Carvajal was a close reader of the Bible. He got his hands on a Bible. He knew Latin. He was able to read the Bible and look for Jewish content in the Bible. Now, he says that his father told him all about this. Highly unlikely. The father didn't read Latin. The father was not that sort of person. But it was a very convenient move to tell the inquisitors that I learned about Passover from my father who died 5 years ago. Always good to blame a dead guy. All right. So this is one example coming from a very educated, self-educated Jew. This is not based on oral tradition. This is based on a direct reading from the Bible. You couldn't have this much detail, right? And his Pesach is not like our Pesach. It's not like the Pesach of the Jews in Venice or in Marrakesh or in Aleppo or in Krakow. This is a very biblical, biblical Pesach. Now let's go to Mallorca, small island. Well, it's the bigger island off the coast of Catalonia, off the coast of the western coast of Spain. The Jews of Mallorca were converted in total during the riots of 1391. They were known then and still to this, till into the 20th century as Chuetas, which was a pejorative term, nickname for them. Chuetas means sausage, because the folktale is that they would hang pork sausages on their windows to show their Catholic neighbors, oh, look, we're really Catholic, we eat pork. And that's the folklore of the Chuetas, but we know that into the 20th century, Chuetas, the Catholics on the island of Mallorca did not marry the Chuetas. They married among themselves. And this was because the other Catholics saw them as not full Christians, despite the fact that they forcibly converted them and didn't let them revert to Judaism. That's the logic. But here we have something from 1678. Think about that. How many years are we after the expulsion? How many years are we since this community was converted? 1391. I mean, this is almost 300 years. And this is what Ana Cortez told the inquisitors. And this comes from a source that my dearly missed friend, David Gitlitz, great historian and a wonderful gentleman who passed away recently in Mexico. David Gitlitz's wonderful book, Secrecy and Deceit, he translated this. So I want to me viga ula le ulam. All right. So let's take a look. This is Ana Cortez. What does she say? In the spring, on a certain day she does not remember, but last year was Holy Thursday, she was to observe a fast called the Feast of the Lamb, Pascua del Cordero. Notice the Spanish. The Spanish word for Easter is Pascua, which comes from, guess what? Pesach, right? It's often used as a term just for holidays, but it's specifically connected to Pesach because obviously the crucifixion is paralleled on the sacrifice of the lamb. Jesus is the lamb, right? The Agnus Dei. So these parallels are very, very rich especially if you think about a person like Ana Cortés or any other converso that is living in a deeply, deeply Catholic world and yet trying to hold on in some way to their Judaism. So she maps it on, first of all, to the calendar of Easter, Holy Thursday, not eating and drinking in the entire day. And after this fast, she was to celebrate the Pascua, the Passover, that lasted for 7 days. And then she should slaughter a lamb, which is to be roasted whole, and to invite her relatives to a feast. And the bones were to be burned, which commemorated the sacrifice of the law of Moses. And on these 7 days, they eat unleavened bread. Nor could she have any leaven in the house. And look at this detail. This is fascinating. And that she was to prepare a little flat cakes on new brick and to cook them on the fire. And these were to be distributed among her relatives. So here we have elements that clearly have roots in the Bible, in the Tanakh, mixed with things that she just clearly was, you know, something that was handed down to her that she kept. Notice how domestic it is. It has to do with how you bake it, using a new brick so that, you know, for chametz. She doesn't explain that, but that's just what she does. But we still have this biblical idea of a lamb roasting it whole. And even, you know, the idea of celebrating with other people. So this is Ana Cortés in Mallorca. So we see in two totally different places, Mallorca, this little island, New Spain, colonial Mexico, from a Jew whose roots were in Portugal and then Spain and then to the colonial world. You know, we see a mix of people holding on to certain traditions, but also clearly connecting with the Bible as a source. Because again, they're living in a world without Jewish books, without Jews to tell them what to do or how to do things. And they have to figure it out in this weird mix of options. Now we turn to something which, you know, if it's amazing that people kept this for 100 years in some form or 200 years, imagine keeping Judaism in secret into the 20th century. And this is just an amazing story. It's a complicated story. It's an unfolding story every day around the world. Experience, I've met people. But today I want to end tonight by talking about the reality of the crypto Jews of Portugal. And it starts the story. I don't know where you want to start the story, but like I said, the biggest group of Jews to leave Spain went to Portugal. They were forcibly converted in 1497. We have generations of Jews who stayed there. And many of those are the ones who go to Amsterdam and London and all sorts of places. But many stayed. They never left. And in particular, there was a group in the mountains in the north of Portugal, in a place called Belmonte, but also other places like Bragança. These are pretty out of the way places. These are not the big cities like Lisbon. And in these towns, we had groups of new Christians, as they were known, who maintained Judaism in some form. This is Captain Arturo Baros Basto, who was a decorated hero of World War I, the Portuguese army, who reconnected to his Jewish roots after the war, went to Morocco to study and to fully embrace Judaism, married this Moroccan Jewish woman, and went back to Portugal to reunite the new Christians of Portugal with Judaism. he started this newspaper, Halapid. He started a small yeshiva in Porto. He started all sorts of educational activities. A very, very active, very interesting guy. Now, this coincides with a kind of brief window in 20th century Portugal, where Portugal embraces liberal republicanism, limits the power of the church, which ran all social activities, right? So all education was in the church's hands, all hospitals, all social services. That was taken apart after the 1910 Republic. But by the 30s, as in counterpart in Spain, the more reactionary conservative forces returned by the 30s and things changed. But Boris Bastow goes to Lisbon, starts this fascinating rejuvenation of the Jewish communities. And I have met, I was 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, I was in Braganza, and I met many people who have very clear memories from their parents talking about this period of time where there were Hebrew schools opening up in these small little villages. And it was this very, very, you know, brief window of Jews coming back. Now, remember, there's no Inquisition in Portugal anymore. That was dismantled in the 1820s. But the fear and the kind of very heightened Catholic culture in these small towns meant that the new Christians kept their Judaism very, very quiet. And so when the conservative dictatorship went back into power, this opening shut again. And they maintained their Judaism again back into secret until Salazar died in 1973, and things started to change, and they started to come up. This is a book written by Samuel Schwartz, who was a Polish-born engineer. He was a very educated man, came from a frum maskilic home. Those things existed. He studied in France and then went to Portugal on business to do some sort of engineering job in the mountains of Portugal, where he is told, oh, they're Jews. They're Jews here. And he's like, what do you mean Jews? There's no Jews anywhere. And that's when he meets these communities. He spends time with them. He studies them. He records much of their prayers and all sorts of other practices. So fast forward, the 1970s, when these communities, now with the new governments, things start to open up. By the 1980s, Frederick Brenner, one of the great, great photographers of the 20th century Jewish experience, is still alive, very active. He spent time photographing this community, and he made a wonderful one, a great, great documentary called The Last Muranos. You can find it online and at, you know, in libraries. And this is a picture of this community, of members of the community, getting ready to bake matzah. They dress all in white. They clean the house. They set up, if you can see down here, you see those kind of, they look like roof tiles. Those are new roof tiles, like Ana Cortez in Mallorca, that they make a fire under, and that's what they make the matzah on. In the movie, you see them making it. Obviously, they don't have to do it in secret anymore, but there's some of them still hold on to the practices, and some of them are doing it just to show how they did it not so long ago. This is them. They pray. It really becomes for them a process of purification, almost like a Kippur. They pray for forgiveness. They pray for kapara. And then they make the matzah. They have another amazing practice, which is going that on the last day of Pesach, they go to a little river, they make a picnic, and they take a stick and they hit the little river, it's a little stream, and they cross it. And they say this prayer. And it's a prayer all about Yetziat Mitzrayim. This is in Portuguese. notice. It's interesting because most of it is very biblical, but then you have these midrashic elements. The sea opens into a dozen pathways. So that's clearly an element of midrash that they absorbed either through oral tradition or through meeting open Jews at some point and absorbing it. And this is what they sing as they are practicing this yitziyat mitzvah, this kriyat yamsuf, during their spring picnic as a community. And it's just a picture of their museum in their town. Obviously things have changed for these groups. But it's an amazing historical wonder that there are people, obviously this is a minority, but there are people who maintain something. Every group is different, but you see the kind of this living memory. And obviously Pesach, which is so central to our identity as Jews, where everything goes back to that we remember Yitzhak Mitzrayim every day, it makes sense that Pesach would be so central to this community. And so this was a bit of a small tour into the world of crypto-Judaism and the ways that it was separate from whatever everyone else was doing in the world Jewishly, but also at the same time maintained all sorts of interesting connections that, you know, maintained it within the world of contemporary Judaism. And it's been a pleasure to be with you tonight. Thank you.